We're wrapping up the seventh in our series of Is There Integrity in Believing? Conversations with a Skeptic About Christ. And today we have a tough subject. This morning is heavy. I know it's heavy. No doubt about it. In fact, as we get through this morning, I think you'll probably leave in a bit of a pensive mood this morning because we're on a subject we have to deal with. You visit with anybody about what it means to be around Christians and those sort of things, and you'll recognize very quickly that why Christians are like that is a major obstacle for somebody following Christ. One of the top two reasons always given for somebody not following Christ is I've met Christians and I didn't like them. Being real honest in this room, I'm going to ask for a show of hands and not the wimpy little ones down here. This is audience participation. Certainly, somewhere in your life, haven't you asked this question? Why are Christians such jerks? Would you raise your hand if you've ever had that thought? Boy, you guys are unrighteous people. I'm just telling you that right now. Sure you have. Sure you have. And it's a legitimate subject. You don't need my stories. We all have our own. Let's go for a couple of reasons this morning for why Christians are like that. Let's go for some explanation. The first, I think, is really essential to understand a biblical text that explains reality. Matthew 13 is the text we're going to start with. Turn, if you would, to Matthew 13, the 24th verse. Matthew 13, verse 24. In Matthew 13, verse 24, starts off, "And Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. And when the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, 'Sir, didn't you sow good seed in the field? Where then did the weeds come from?' 'An enemy did this,' he replied. The servants asked him, 'Do you want us to go and pull them up?' 'No,' he answered, 'because while you're pulling up the weeds, you may root up the wheat with them. No, let them both grow together until the harvest. At that time, I will tell the harvesters, first collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned, and then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn.'" You recognize this is not a conversation about farming. It's a conversation for church. Here's what the Lord says. I want you to know that within the kingdom, within the concept of what people will look at, and people say, "Wow, that's the kingdom of God." Please know there are going to be two parallel streams. There are two groups of people. They exist side by side in the same field. They exist in the same church. They exist in the same family. And there are two side by side. One, the Lord calls wheat, that which produces the result you want, that the result of the harvest that he wants, and the other is called weeds. And he makes a simple statement you please need to know. They will exist side by side for a while. There will come a day they no longer exist side by side. They have different destinations. Matthew chapter 7. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says this. It's an extended passage. We're not going to go through the whole of it, but let me jump in the middle of it in verse 21. In verse 21 of Matthew 7, Jesus says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Now many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, didn't we prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and perform many miracles, and I preached a lot of sermons, and I taught a lot of Bible school classes, and I gave a lot of money, and Lord, I raised my family in church,' and I mean, you can fill all the details in you want." Verse 23, "And then I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.'" There's a sad truth I don't like, nobody likes. But the reality is that under the name of Christ, or under this large overarching banner, there's always going to be two groups. One group will be those who have the heart of the Master and the heart of the King. There'll be a second group who has the name but not the heart. They will exist side by side. That's always been the case. You even go into the Old Testament, you're going to notice in the Old Testament when Moses goes up on top of the mountain to meet with God, and there's a real encounter with God. At the exact same time, the encounter with God is occurring at the top of the mountain that's real and legitimate and transforming. In fact, he comes down and his face even glows from being in the encounter with God. At the bottom of the mountain is a golden calf crowd. And the golden calf syndrome will always be the case. Now, here's an amazing thing you need to recognize. Both groups are using the same language. Moses on top of the mountain is speaking of the good things God has done, which would be the Red Sea and release from captivity and all the grace and all the mercy God has given them. And the second crowd is using similar language. But if you'll take a look, it is absolute personal debauchery using the name of God to accomplish whatever your personal lusts are. And those two exist side by side. If you think about it, everywhere that there's something valuable or right or true, there's a knockoff, an imitation, a counterfeit. I remember when our oldest child, Troy, was probably first, second grade, 6, 7 years old. I don't know how old he was. It was close to Mother's Day. And for some reason, this one impacts me emotionally deeper than lots of other memories. It had to do with a little boy's exuberance and a conversation a father had to have with him. Troy watched an infomercial, and he was so excited. He was so excited. Dad, we can get diamonds for Mom for Mother's Day. They're only $16 or $14 or whatever it was. We can get her bunches of them. And, you know, I mean, I've got, you know, money. We'll get Mom diamonds. And the exuberance of a little boy is fun, but I remember a painful conversation of a little boy who has to be told a truth you'd never want to tell your kids, which is, son, you're in a world where there are good things and scoundrels side by side. And the scoundrels use the same language as the good guys. And I remember that conversation with some emotion. The reality of the knockoff and the imitation, you see it everywhere. You go into a convenience store and they won't take your $100 bill. I'm sure you take that along often in there, but you take your $100 bill and they got signed. They won't take it. Why? Because somebody else makes $100 bills off copy machines. In the same city where there is a marriage and love and tenderness and sex in that marriage, and sex being one of the most tender gifts God gives to a couple, in that same marriage that loves one another, you find the imitation, the counterfeit. Because in that same city, there'll be prostitution and adultery and kids in backseats of cars. And we'll use the same words, love. Truth is, it's nothing of the same. It's a million miles apart. It shouldn't surprise us there's imitations of the real. The phrase that most historians use, most of us use, and there's other ways to describe, but most of us say, if you want to call the two, one of them is Christendom and one of them is Christianity. Christianity is where you're a Christ follower and where every part of your life you begin to line up of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, and a transformation and a Christ-following Christian is one thing. The other word is Christendom. Christendom basically takes the concept of taking a culture or taking your personal agenda and putting Christian language with it and using the church and trying to soothe your conscience and trying to do all kinds of things, both working the crowd in of Christianity and also wanting to make yourself feel better about personal deception in your life. And so Christendom and Christianity oftentimes are confused, but they are worlds apart. In Matthew 13, when Jesus said, I'm going to take the weeds, and they'll be gathered up and they'll be burnt, you need to know Christendom doesn't have much of a future. The concept of what will take place is they may exist side by side. Well, you say, well, why? Why would the church let them rest side by side? The answer is because until the harvest comes, so to speak, until later where the fruit is shown, I don't know who's in Christendom. I can't read the heart. And if I were really reading the heart, I'd end up doing more damage to people with innocence than at some point in time I say, look, reading the heart's God's job. I can't do that. But what I can say is time will always bring the fruit to the surface, and God himself will take care of it. and he speaks in judgment term. One of the realities about life that the Christian message clearly holds is this, is that justice even supersedes this world. That justice may not occur in the next 20 minutes, but I guarantee you, even if someone dies, they didn't escape justice. Justice is inevitable. In Mark chapter 9, there's a passage with emotion in it. Mark chapter 9 is a passage where Jesus tells his own emotion. In Mark 9, verse 42, Jesus said, "If anyone causes one of these little ones who believes in me to sin, it'd be better for him to be thrown into the sea with a large millstone tied around his neck." Now, let me just take that for a second. We'll use that passage later on. But if for the moment, it's just this concept. You take somebody who would be a stumbling block. You take your Christendom life, and you cause somebody else, the innocent, to fall and stumble because of your life. You're going to wish you had a huge millstone tied around your neck with chains, and you're going to wish you were cast in the depths of the sea. Need to read that for what it is. It's pretty deep emotion on the Lord's part. My grandfather, mom's side, was one of the gentlest men I've ever met. I mean, he was an incredibly gentle man. He was gracious to anyone and everyone. Only saw him mad one time, and that was at me. I was 10, 11, I don't know how old I was, 12, 22. I was 10 or 12. I have three younger brothers and sisters. So there's four of us in the family, and I was left in charge of my three younger siblings. And by some successful means, I had them all crying. I don't know. Somebody needed punched, I'm sure. I mean, what's the good of being the oldest if you can't punch somebody every now and then? You know, I mean, I'm sure that was kind of my logic. My grandfather came into the house. Nobody else was around. Parents were out doing something probably related to a combine or a tractor or something. And I got three siblings crying, and I'm telling you, my grandfather, this gentle man who I didn't think had a temper, has one. He has one. Took my shirt, not in a threatening way, but he took my shirt, and my grandfather's voice was quivering when he said, "Don't you ever hit my grandchildren. Don't you ever hit my grandkids." And he gave me a lecture of his great affection and their great value. I think of that every time I ever read that passage, only the next one who grabs my shirt won't be a grandfather. It will be somebody who said, "Why did you let your Christendom life, how dare you let it tear up their lives? You're going to wish a big stone had been tied around your neck and you were cast in the middle of the sea instead of having to deal with me. But deal with me you will." Let me take an aside here for a second. If you're living a Christendom life and you're in this crowd and you're sitting here today and you use all the spiritual language and you use all the covering and you call the name of Christ as if it's an affectionate word to you, but you do not have the heart of Christ lived out in how you live, you need to know the jig is up as far as kingdom things are concerned. How dare you be abusive with your wife? How dare you be a rough-handed man with your children? How dare you be an angry man? And you couch everything, and I keep my family in church, and I have Christian values, and you just use all the language you want to of Christian stuff. But if you do not live with the heart of Christ, it is time to call it what it is. You're phony. And your phoniness is long discovered because the fruit of that life, Jesus says, will be weighed in light of what I ask and what I wanted. In Luke chapter 6, Jesus says, "How can you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I ask?" That's why in Matthew 7, he will say, there are tons of people who will use the word Lord, and I'm going to say, "Depart from me, I never knew you." Christendom is entirely different than Christianity. They use a similar language, but they go different directions. We could talk about a lot of things. You tell me. you tell me whether or not your sexual life matches the heart of Christ. You tell me whether or not your speech matches the heart of Christ. And on it goes. When someone says, I reject Christianity, they often bring up, because of all the things that they see around the world and in history, they will say, well, what about Northern Ireland? Protestants and Catholics blowing each other up and those sort of things. And again, that's a little more in my day, but what about the Salem witch trials? What about the Crusades? And on it goes. I hate many of the things that have the name of Christ on them, but I want to remind you there's a difference between Christendom and Christianity. Maybe this will help. Back in the late 60s, I can't explain why. I have no idea why it took place. But in the late 60s, there was about a year and a half or 2 years of pretty violent interaction between my high school that I was a part of and the Mount Vernon High School, Lamar and Mount Vernon. Can't hardly believe that, but there was. You drive buses into either one of the schools during that year and a half or 2 years, and the tires were slashed. There were windows broken out of buses. There were rocks that were thrown at players, both football players and basketball players, on their way to buses. It was a bit violent. You had to have police escorts on a couple of the games, that there were police who were there to sit and watch the buses. And you're going, gee whiz, this is Southwest Missouri with rednecks. What in the world are we doing? You know? But it was taking place. Now, can I ask you to do a diagnosis of that animosity? Well, you can guess what it was. It was the superintendents out there spitting at one another and throwing gravel and rocks at each other. Librarians throwing books. Here, have a Moby Dick. And they were throwing it. And, you know, here, you know, the Tale of Two Cities came flying back. And you know that wasn't the case. You also know it wasn't the student councils out there. Boy, they're just really fighting and cussing and screaming and shouting. It wasn't that. So who's slashing tires and who's throwing rocks? The answer is the drunks. The answer is it's the delinquents who carried war on during the day with their own school. The ones that the superintendents were calling in and kicking out of school themselves. It was, if I can care to say so, it was the weeds out of both schools with far too much alcohol. If I can borrow that illustration, you see, it's the very people who the Christians struggle with in their own families, the very ones the Christians struggle with in their own churches, the very one the Christians struggle with in their own culture. That's the Christendom that causes, as Romans chapter 2 says, the name of God to be blasphemed among the nations. Jesus himself said, you're going to encounter wolves, and they're going to be in sheep's clothing. Well, how do you know? Dear brother or sister, you need to know Christ so well. You need to know the heart of Christ so well. Stop knowing so much about the church. Know Christ. Know Christ so well. Know what he thinks. Know what the words of Christ are. Know what his life is. Hear the call of Christ. And when you know clearly what the call of Christ is, it's not hard to tell Christendom from Christianity. There's a world of difference. But if you don't know Christ, you'll get sucked into Christendom. In fact, let me warn you, every now and then, Christendom sounds alluring because Christendom will use Bible verses and it'll use some certain names, and Christendom will say, hey, come, and they'll use words that entice you, maybe in politics or maybe in finances or maybe, I don't know, power, maybe about wealth. I don't know what it is, but it'll words that sound kind of right to you, and you'll start following Christendom. Don't go there. You won't like how the story turns out. Let me talk to you about real Christianity. What's the real thing do? Well, I'll tell you, historians constantly point this out. Believing and unbelieving historians constantly point out there is a turning of the historical page when Christ and those who accept his message really come into a culture or a place, they radically change the world. And they radically change the world on this singular issue, the value of human life. Throughout humanity, human life's been cheap. It's true. Human beings will behave like a wolf toward other people they do not know who are not a part of their family. History clearly shows it. But the incredible worth of one human being that comes out of the message of Christ and those who accept his message changes everything. Dignity and the worth of a human being is radically changed in the culture. Throughout history, human life has been cheap. So children took it on the chin. They're pretty powerless. Kids don't defend themselves very well. You look at the pages of history. When Christ and the impact of Christ on a culture comes, they don't abandon their children anymore. They don't abandon their children. One of your views of Rome, which you need to keep in mind, is that the Christianity that went to Rome was a Christianity that came into a Rome that just because you had children didn't mean you had to keep them. There were numerous towers built all around Rome, and one of the more common sights that you would see was a baby was born, but the baby had a club foot, or the baby was born and it was a girl and we don't need another girl, or the baby was born and I just don't want the boy. And they took children and they set them on columns and towers. They had ladders. You'd take them and you set them, and you would hear, historians will tell you, you'd hear the cries of babies on towers around the city until the ravens got there or the crows. And literally, the death of children was common. Why? They're just kids. Throughout history, in every culture you want to look in, there's been a pattern that says you sort your kids and you throw away the girls, and you keep the stronger-looking boys if you want to. Throughout history, there have been places you have lots of kids because you can hire them out. Southeast Asia, this horrible pit of sexual immorality with children is not because there's too much Christianity's come there. In fact, it's just the opposite. The Roman historians commented that they don't kill their offspring, these Christians, and they gather in our children. You read the Old Testament and you recognize every now and then that how upset the prophets were at the Baal and the Asheroth. Those were two gods that were worshipped, the Baal and the Asheroth. And you kind of read through the Old Testament and go, wow, those prophets are pretty ticked. Boy, they don't like the Baal and the Asheroth. I wonder why. Well, it'd be a lot of reasons, but one of them would be lots of little jars. Even now, archaeological sites, anywhere you find it, Baal and Asheroth has been a major spot. There'll be jars buried, lots and lots of jars, jars and jars and jars. And you open the jars and they're the remains of child sacrifice. You can give a kid up if you want a good spring rain. Just sacrifice a child for a good spring rain. Maybe the gods will give that to you. The call of Christ is about the worth and value of your human life. It's the reason abortion is, quite frankly, not a political issue as I understand it, and I don't think it is for most of us here. There are lots of complex issues about poverty and other things about abortion, but one of the things you have to decide is the value of a human life and when do you start protecting human life. The message of Christ has been that humans matter, and that's a really, really different message than cultures have historically had. The life of women. Historically, look at cultures throughout history. The lives of women, with the exceptions of a few bright spots here and there, for the most part, you gals have had a tough world to live in. For when you decide you want to tear apart the reign of a creator and decide that every man does what's right in his own eyes, I promise you, women, you have trouble holding back the brute force of men. Women have been chattel. They've been property and slaves and prostitutes. And it was men who drove it. Charles Spurgeon noted that there was a common question when you went into a culture with the scriptures, and you really begin to teach the scriptures. One of the most common questions was this: did a woman write your Bible? Why would you ask, did a woman write her Bible? Because your Bible is so kind to women. The concept of the biblical message of human dignity. I depressed myself yesterday morning, and I knew I was going to. I didn't stumble on it, and I went and looked for it. I knew it was there. Julie asked me if something was wrong, and I actually didn't tell her the full story because I didn't want to talk about it, I'm sure. I'm a guy. I said I was working on my sermon, and that's the truth. I read the New York Times article yesterday titled "The Invisible War." It's what's taking place currently, not in a 3-block area, not in a 6-block area, but a spot of the northern Congo, and about the liberation armies that are at war there. The invisible war is basically a war on women. You read that article, Bob Herbert wrote it, you don't necessarily want to, but you read that article. He's a columnist for the Times. And they talk about going into spots and literally having 100 women that are waiting. Now, I went to other spots, and I mean, there's multiple authors of the same thing, so I don't know what to quote to Bob and what to others, but said lines of 8 and 9 and 10-year-old girls who are all incontinent because of just the abuse of humanity upon them. Describe taking an ambulance in, and you can put 10 in the ambulance, and you have 93, 95 you left. Not because they were worse off, or not better off than the ones in the ambulance, but you had 10, you had room for 10 in your ambulance. Now you tell me, in a world that's full of tooth and claw, is the message of Christ, does it matter? I've been reading the Times more in the last few months. That's the reason I appreciated an article that came out at the end of December. Didn't know when to use it, but this is as good a time as any. Matthew Paris is a columnist for the Times as well. Here's his article. It's 3 pages. It's entitled, "As an Atheist, I Truly Believe Africa Needs God." Interesting spot to start. Malawi is the country that he grew up in. He knows it's his home. Let me read a portion of it. He said, "In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation, and the rebirth is real, and the change is good." He said, "I used to avoid this truth by applauding, as you can, the practical work of missions churches in Africa. But it's a pity, I would say, that salvation has to be a part of that package. But Christians, black and white, working in Africa, do heal the sick. They do teach people to read and write. And only the severest kind of secularist could see a mission hospital or school and say the world would be better off without it. I used to allow that if faith was needed to motivate the missionaries to help them, fine. But what counted was the help, not the faith." But Matthew Paris says, "But that doesn't fit the facts, and I can't say that anymore. Faith does more than support the missionary. It also is transferred to his flock. And this is the effect that matters so immensely, in which I cannot help observing." Now, he goes through lots of paragraphs, and I can't read them all, but he says, "We had working for us Africans who had converted and were strong believers, and the Christians were always different. Far from having been cowed or confined, their faith appeared to liberate them to dignity, and they stood tall. Not just a dignity for themselves, but a dignity for others, and they were the ones who put the machetes down. They were the ones who stopped mistreating the neighbor's kids. They were the ones. Whenever we entered a territory worked by missionaries, we had to acknowledge that something changed in the face of the people we passed and spoke to." And again, dignity in human life. Let me just finish with his last paragraph. "Those who want Africa to walk tall amidst 21st century global competition must not kid themselves that providing the material means or even the know-how that accompanies what we call development will make that change. No, a whole belief system has to be supplanted. and I'm afraid it has to be supplanted by another. Removing Christian evangelism from the African equation may leave the continent at the mercy of a malign fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete. The London Times, many years back, the London Times wrote an article, or had a series of articles, in which they blasted missionaries. They said, look, all the peoples of the world are happy. Leave them alone. The missionaries should stay in England and stop going. Let the peoples of the world just be happy the way they are. One man wrote in. He wrote in and said, I have traveled the world extensively, and I can say with certainty that you better hope wherever you travel, Christian missionaries have gotten there before you. Because the value of a human life has changed where they are. And without it, you're at risk. Sincerely yours, Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin had a problem. To his death, he had a problem. He came to believe that the world came about by natural means and it was random chance and selection, but the problem was he couldn't figure out what do you do with worth and dignity and the value of a human life, and he couldn't figure out how you put those two together. This idea of made in the image of God, but random. And Darwin came to the defense more than once of what Christian missionaries do for the children of a culture and the women of a culture and the justice of a culture and the kindness of a culture. Your hospitals came about because no one would take care of the sick, the poor, and hostels were put in where somebody said, let them live with us, we will. And the Mother Teresa's and on it goes. Education came in, not because we didn't know how to educate, but we always thought it was just the rich people who could afford special tutors. But when you said every human life has worth and value, and education ought to go to everybody, there's a central message of Christ of the worth of a human being. No doubt about it, some in Christendom sit in churches and sing, and no doubt about it, some in Christendom find ways to shroud their deeds of darkness with the covering of the name of Christ. Christians, they love. I've been in this community for a long time now. And I can tell you there are kind people of every kind of persuasion, but I will tell you this, it's unmistakable. Any honest man would have to say that when you find people up to their elbows in the lives of others, deeply immersed in loving them, the hydrant that it flows from is a person who's been changed by Christ. Now, Christendom may use the language, but it's not the same. Do we love perfectly? Of course not. Of course not. No, actually, there's a second reason why Christians are the way they are, and this won't take long. I'll hurry. There's a second reason Christians are that way, and it has to do with immaturity. Immaturity. When one decides to become a follower of Christ, you're still a follower of Christ, but man, there's some still stumbling and growing up and learning what it means to follow Christ. I read the letter to the Corinthians, and they're so immature, and yet Paul still calls them saints. Immaturity. What do we do with immature people? Let's take a small child. What do we do with immature? Well, the answer is we just tell them to get over it. So you have a child, 9, 10, 11 months. This child has been living off borrowed arms their whole life. This child hadn't walked anywhere. And so you turn to your 11-month-old child and you say, hey, kid, time for you to grow up. Time for you to stop this mooching off life. Time for you to walk. And you say, get your hands off that couch. And you take that child and set him in the middle of the room and you say, now you walk. You hear me? You're 11 months old. Time for you to walk. You have a cousin walking. You know it reflects on us when you're 11 months and you don't walk? Humiliating to us. And so the child takes a step and falls down, and you go over and you say, you stupid child, don't you fall like that. That humiliates us even more. And don't fall when somebody else can see you. Nah, we don't do that stuff. We pick up 11-month-old kids, and we hug them, and we put them back on their feet again, and they fall, and we'll even write in our journal, "Hey, he started walking today." Well, he fell more than he walked. Why didn't you write, "He started falling today"? He's better at that. We recognize there's a maturity that just has to occur. It's the reason the scripture says, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourself with compassion and kindness and gentleness. You go through that text. Why? Because everybody here knows something about that maturing process. I was in Lexington, Kentucky about 4 years ago. I lose track of time a few years back. Julie and I were sitting at a restaurant. It wasn't necessarily an upscale restaurant, but it certainly wasn't a shack of any kind. The guy behind us at a booth was just so vulgar. He just kept cussing up a storm. I mean, he was every blue word that you want. He knew those words. And I grew up where I know those words. I mean, they're not exactly like I got an education I never heard before, but he was just over the edge. Julie went up, got up, and I think she probably went to the restroom or something, or pay. She often does that. Anyhow, Julie got up and left, and I don't know. I took a risk I don't normally take. In fact, I don't know that I have before or since. But I knew I could run if I needed to. So I turned around to the booth, and I said to the guy, I said, "I apologize. I said, I don't do this. This is really awkward for me. I don't mean to make it awkward for you, but you know, don't you, that your language isn't just the same one that all cultures come from, and not everybody's as comfortable with that language as you are, and it really makes it pretty awkward to be in a social place." And I don't know how I finished the sentence, but something. He stood up. He didn't have any idea who I was, and here was what he said. He said, "I am so sorry." He said, "I am so sorry." He said, "I was just baptized. I've just become a Christian." He said, "I'm a member at the Southland Christian Church." And he said, "I've got to change this part. I am so sorry. Could I go apologize to your wife? Could I?" And I told him, no, wasn't any problem with that. But do you know what? That's a guy who's going to make it. That's a kid who turned loose of the couch and started walking across the floor. And it's okay if you stumble some. And I know the world's going to beat guys like that up and say, "You see those Christians? There's not a bit of difference." But that's a guy who's maturing. He's going to make it. I'd love to know who he was in church now. I'd love to go back and meet this guy of transformation at the Southland Christian Church. Here's my question. Who are you? Are you Christendom or are you Christianity? The difference is severe. May God bless.